Tonight on Agents of Cool, we take you back to the wild and woolly four-color comic scene of 1989. We take you back to a long-lost publisher named Eclipse Comics. We take you back with the great, great writer and artist Mike Grell. We take you back to a James Bond series you've never heard of, but after this show you're going to track down, called Permission to Die. Welcome to Agents of Cool. Tonight we have a slightly off-the-beaten-track episode for you. We are moving into comics territory tonight. We are reviewing, specifically, a James Bond miniseries from the 1989-1990 period. It is entitled Permission to Die. It is written and drawn by the great Mike Grell. Now, I don't know how many of you out there listening to us are actually comic book fans. If you are Mike Grell, the name should be familiar to you, and even if it's not, the work is probably familiar to you. Mike Grell was one of the great DC artists of the 1970s. He was a huge fan of your pulp magazines, your newspaper comic strips, initially got into illustration, cartooning, comics because he wanted to be a newspaper comic strip artist, ended up working for DC in the 1970s, did significant work on Batman and Green Arrow in the 70s for DC. His 70s work, he's mostly known for a landmark work on Legion of Superheroes. And that work is, you know, reprinted in hardbacks these days and is prized amongst collectors. And if you type in Mike Grell Legion of Superheroes into a search engine, you're going to see some genuine classic 1970s superhero artwork. Mr. Grell goes on to become one of the most significant independent creators of the 1980s. He jumped ship from DC to go to work for First Comics, the publishing company out of Chicago in the early 1980s, where he created, wrote, and drew a series called John Sable for a number of years. John Sable is about a former soldier of fortune who doubles as a children's book writer, and it featured hard-hitting action and beautiful women and international locations and a knowledge of weapons and violence, all of which would, of course, play into the assignment he would later get for James Bond.
Also, now, there was a short-lived TV series based
and
on...
And also, there was a very short-lived TV series based on Sable, which had a very young Rene Russo as one of the female leads, and which actually was a pretty good adaptation of that comic. I remember watching some episodes of that. It was not a bad show at all.
I remember seeing it. I was a big, giant Equalizer fan in the 80s, like anybody that likes spy shows and has a pulse.
And John Sable is not a million miles away from the Equalizer.
Right, so
anyway.
This is like any of these spy stuff on TV, not just having to wait for the ABC movie of the week. And it's like, here's another spy show. And that was really cool. So I didn't know I think it was years later, because, you know, I didn't really have regular access to comics at that point. Yeah. I mean, it was basically what was in the spinner rack at Winn-Dixie. And John Sable Freelance was probably a little niche for the local Winn-Dixie
or
Kroger. But
I had to whine and cry around in the 80s to get taken to the comic stores in the big cities.
See, I didn't...
Dad, take me to this store. I didn't read a lot of it, but whatever I was able to get my hands on was good stuff.
I didn't know until years after it was off the show, this was based on a comic book.
Yeah, and a damn fine one.
It probably was in the credits, but you're not really looking at the credits when you're... How old are we would have been when Sable was on?
Maybe 15. And even if you are a comics fan and haven't heard of him, you are familiar with the TV show Arrow. Now, Grell did a graphic novel in the mid-1980s called Green Arrow, The Longbow Hunters. And I think it was the first big sort of grown-up prestige format comic DC Comics did in the aftermath of Dark Knight, and was a retooling of Green Arrow from less a superhero with the boxing glove Arrow and more to an urban hunter. Redesigned his costume, gave him a new attitude, a new style, a new ambiance, and then proceeded. He wrote and drew that graphic novel and then wrote the monthly comic for several years thereafter. And you can look at Arrow, the smash hit TV series that's, you know, been the spearhead of a new wave of superhero shows on TV. Arrow, Flash, Legends of Tomorrow, Supergirl, that whole production entity right there. And it's all founded on, in large measure, to the style and ambiance Mike Grell had on Longbow Hunters back in the 80s. Now, you could look at Arrow and say they're doing that pretty clearly the Chris Nolan version of Green Arrow, because they couldn't do Batman, one assumes. So they're doing the Chris Nolan Arrow, but the Chris Nolan Arrow, as it happens, also has a great deal in common with Mike Grell's Longbow Hunters. And then he does that for a number of years. He had an Image comic in the 1990s called Shaman's Tears. He also did significant work on Iron Man, including having Tony Stark reveal his secret identity. And I will go on record with this. I do think the way Tony's secret identity was revealed in Mike Grell's comics tracks pretty closely with the way Robert Downey dropped it at the end of that first movie. Because the way Mike Grell had him do it was a very sort of off-the-cuff, casual, spur-of-the-moment kind of thing, not unlike the way they did at the end of the first Iron Man movie. So until somebody tells me otherwise, I do think there's an influence there. So Mike Grell, not to put too fine a point on it, is one of the greats. He's a phenomenal illustrator. He's a terrific writer. I have read comments over the years suggesting that he has lived a very interesting life outside of comics. For example, I know he's been on safari in Africa a couple of times. He's actually a veteran. He knows a little bit about, maybe a lot about, this world of hard men. And I almost forgot his most significant creation in the 70s. Warlord? How could I? Warlord.
I was about to say, for those of you, fans of Edgar Rice Burroughs and Hollow Earth and that sort of thing.
Travis Morgan, the Warlord.
Yeah. That.
How could I forget
oddly
that?
Oddly looks a lot like Oliver Queen.
Are you saying that goateed superheroic characters for DC Comics, both drawn by Mike Grell, bear a striking physical resemblance to each other?
Why, it's true.
Huh. Fancy that. And Warlord is about a U.S. Air Force pilot named Travis Morgan who crashes and gets drawn into a fantastical sort of inner world of the Earth called Skartaris. Ran for years and years to the late 70s and early 80s. Inner Earth, Edgar Rice Burroughs, pulpy action adventure. So Mr. Grell has basically done it all. He's done superheroes and action and adventure and fantasy and science fiction, and sometimes he's done it all in one comic. His skill as an illustrator is, in my opinion, undimmed. And he's, frankly, he's also a hell of a nice guy to talk to because we had a chance to interview him for the show.
There's also a story where he pulled out a .45 during some contract negotiations with either DC or Marvel, I forget which. True story, sort of, kind of. Don't want to spoil it, but if you get to see Mike Grell at a convention, the question's going to come up. It's a nice story.
And if you do meet him at a convention, by all means, go up, ask him a question, talk to him. He is one of those creators who would have every right to be very standoffish and stuck on himself, but you could not find someone easier to walk up and just talk to. Swear to God, I did it. I mean, you could not find somebody who is easier to talk to. Specifically, for purposes of our show, we're going to be reviewing his comic Permission to Die. It was published by Eclipse Comics in the late, 1989-1990. Eclipse Comics was also one of those big 1980s independent comics pioneers. They are no longer around. They went out of business not long after they finished publishing this comic, for that matter. You can look them up. They were a pretty significant publisher in the 80s, but they're, gone now. This comic is freaking fantastic. Now, we've all read it. I will go out on a limb and say that we're looking at something here. Hits that Venn diagram between the Fleming novels and the really good Connery Bond movies.
Yeah, I liked it quite a bit. I think it could have maybe used 4 issues.
Yeah, I thought it was a little short.
It's really good, and it tells a complete James Bond. Mm. I mean, it's basically, it is about as pitch-perfect spot-on James Bond movie as you could get. In fact, there's a chase sequence in book 2 that just absolutely, it just absolutely nails just the perfect, all the bits and pieces you'd want in a good movie chase, and especially a good James Bond chase with helicopters and trains. And again, don't want to spoil it, but there's a bit at the end where the tables get turned, and I didn't see it coming. Certainly the people the tables got turned on didn't see it coming. I'm like, I could totally see that on the big screen. In fact, I would love to see that on the big screen because it's great.
I'm looking at that sequence right now, and the ending of the sequence he's talking about, it does that thing like the really good entertainers across all mediums do, which is take an expectation and turn it on its head. How should we phrase this? It looks at something from a different direction, let's say.
It draws the audience's focus to one part, and then all of a sudden you sort of pull back and realize, oh wait, that's where they're doing this thing, and then kablammo, and it's great. There's a couple bits where I'm not sure the action quite translated as well. Part of the problem we've got is, I think the first book we've got, the margins are a little dicey. It's like the bleed was slightly off on that particular printing where some of the text runs right into the border margin there. So there's one action sequence and one of them where it's like, I think I know what's going on here, but it's a little hard to make out because parts of the action were just in short of slicing up your comics with an X-Acto knife, which
we don't do.
It's against
my religion.
So there are one or two places where I was like, I'm not quite following the action going here, but surprisingly few. And this is the thing, for a visual medium, there's some actions that don't translate really well to the comic book page. So being able to do multiple really good action sequences that put you in the mood of a movie that feel like that, that's I think quite an accomplishment.
When you finish reading it and you feel like you've watched something that moved, and all it is just ink on paper. And that's a testament to this guy's skill as an artist.
Yeah, these are not like storyboards. This is not like, okay, here's the storyboard frame by frame. This is not the freeze frame film comic storybook. I mean, these are comic pages, and he uses a whole bunch of different illustrative techniques,
all the skills on all the things that comics allow you to do.
It really did to me feel like this is a really good James Bond movie.
And if you thought for a minute there that they were getting toward the end of the plot and it hadn't gotten quite over the top enough for proper cinematic James Bond, then you get to the third issue.
Yes.
Now issues one and two. Well, let's start with issue one. Issue one, Permission to Die. You open it up and you've got, the first thing you open up, you've got a dancing topless gypsy. God bless you, Mike. You really do know how to draw women. And then you've got a shot of Bond himself. Now, I don't know if we brought this up in the show before, but Ian Fleming has often said that Bond himself looked like the popular singer of his day, Hoagy Carmichael. And Mr. Grell took Mr. Fleming at his word, and so this is basically Bond drawn as Hoagy Carmichael. You can look Hoagy Carmichael up on the internet, and bam, here he is. The weird thing about it is, if you sort of put your hand over the bottom half of this illustration, like the top of Hoagy Carmichael's head looks a lot like the top of Sean Connery's head.
Some of that's the hair. I think he said in the interview he did kind of update the hairstyle.
He did. And then you open the book, and there's a pre-title sequence where a sort of state dinner is being interrupted by your terrorist types. And then here's Bond in a kilt.
The best part, I don't want to spoil too much, because this goes in there, you know, we can kind of touch on it some of the book. I mean,
sure.
This is available for reprint, right? This is not the same.
Not that I know of.
Yes, oh, boy.
Eclipse is down, and I haven't seen this reprinted anywhere. Now, see, this is the sad thing. I don't think this is available digital. And if you guys want to read this, you're going to have to go to eBay. You're going to have to go to comic stores.
Ooh.
You're going to have to go to conventions. This may take you some effort to track down.
Oh, okay.
And if you listen to this podcast and you want to read this, we're kind of setting you up a little bit, because this is going to be hard to find. It's kind of sorry, not sorry, because I'm sorry you're going to the trouble, but once you found it, you're going to be glad you did.
See, that's the thing. I don't necessarily want to spoil it for folks, but if it's really hard to find...
How are we going to discuss it for this period of time?
Interesting question.
Well, how about this? We're going to hit on some of the high points in the plot and the story. We're going to hint at some of this as we talk about it, but the experience of reading this comic is going to be very different from the experience of us talking about it. Again, because Mike Grell is one of the greats, and his knowledge of everything necessary to make a good James Bond comic is on display on pretty much every page here. So we're probably gonna spoil a little bit of you, but once you found this and read it, you're gonna thank us for it anyway. So
that pre-title sequence, that it's a state dinner, terrorists have seized the place, they're negotiating with the police outside, and apparently, you know, the SAS have been dispatched and they're on their way.
But they're not going to get there.
Yeah, the terrorists are getting increasingly itchy and tetchy and twitchy, and they're basically going to, you know, execute somebody. And there's a close-up shot on Diner wearing a kilt.
It's a male. He's wearing a kilt. His hand reaches into what looks like a garter on his leg, and he pulls a throwing knife out very, you know, subtly.
It's the little Scottish ceremonial dagger.
Yeah.
His name escapes me right now.
And then suddenly the terrorists hear the sound of a helicopter. Things are getting south, bullets are about to fly, and suddenly there's a terrorist there with a knife, that same knife in his neck, and then bam, 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 bullets fly. The guest in the kilt knocks the chair over backwards, bam, goes to the holster on his leg underneath his kilt, bam, pulls out what looks suspiciously like a Walther PPK, bam, bam, terrorist down, SAS guys crash through the window. A couple more terrorists go down, but basically the day has already been saved. And suddenly this glamorous woman walks up to the man in the kilt. And she says, I've often wondered what a Scot wears under his kilt. Mr. Say it with me as you listen to the show. Bond.
James Bond.
And then you turn the page, and it's almost the title sequence for the film. It's a montage of your significant events. You've got
Dr. No.
You've got poor Jill in her gold paint. You've got what looked like... I mean,
Scuba divers
from Thunderball. You've got the scene of Bond marrying Tracy. Now, here's the thing. This book was not licensed through the film company. This book was licensed through the Fleming Estate, whatever name it was they were going under at the time.
Well,
it might have been
very much the Dr. No from the movie, though, not just with the metal hand and such.
But is that actually Joe Wiseman?
That's not Diana Rigg.
It's Tracy. It's obviously Tracy, but it's not Diana Rigg.
That's the thing. Artistically, you know, he's an artist. He took the artistic license. You got the impression, okay, that you got what he was going for, even though he got basically distilled down to the essence of these movies in one little scene without quite infringing on them.
Yeah, because at this point, people argue between the Bond of the books and the Bond of the movies, and I think we've even had those discussions before. But there also comes a point where Bond is Bond is Bond. There's going to be...
Yeah, this guy is obviously descended from both.
Yeah. So what have we got here? So then you go on into the Bond story where Bond goes in to meet M, who doesn't really look like Robert Brown, who was M at the time, and doesn't really look like Robert Brown, but is also unmistakably M.
Looks a lot like Moneypenny from the movies, though, I thought.
Let's see, where's Penny?
That scene right there.
You think she looks like Lois?
A little bit. I mean, I could tell just from looking that she was Moneypenny. So.
Well, you see, this is also what he's doing here. He's also making sure that you know that's Moneypenny, but it's not quite Lois. And there's the, and of course, we go through the assignment scene. There is an Eastern European scientist, and I've never actually said this name aloud, so bear with me. Speaking of Eastern European, Eric Widziadlow. There's a scientist named Eric Widziadlow who has come up with a new low-cost launching technique for satellites and rockets and whatnot, and he's going to give it to the English if the English can get someone out for him. Identified as his niece. Well, what was her name? I've never actually said these.
Gala, I think.
I've never actually said these out loud. So, Miss Edain, is it Edain? Miss Edain Gala, his only living relative and a brilliant physicist in her own right. His niece in Hungary, and he will give this launching system to Great Britain if Great Britain will get his niece out. Of course, it's Bond's mission. He takes it. There's some banner with Penny. He goes and sees Major Boothroyd. Major Boothroyd, who doesn't look a thing like Desmond Whelan, but who does oddly look like Harry Mudd.
That's true.
Yeah, he does look like
oddly, he looks like Roger C. Carmel with the handlebar, you know, mustache and whatnot, the guy that played Harry Mudd on Star Trek. And as our resident firearms expert, I'm going to leave it to Ray to talk about the new firearm that Bond is assigned.
So he gets the ASP 9mm, which is, it's a cut down, heavily modified Smith & Wesson M39. You can go look it up. This was one of the, or this was written, when was this written? This was 89. So in the late 70s, early 80s, small compact guns that function in proper self-defense calibers were kind of uncommon. And the ASP was one of the examples of one that worked and was essentially set up for concealment. It's coated in Teflon.
You have it made from.
Yeah, they took a Smith & Wesson M39 and chopped and lopped and rewelded the trigger guard and a bunch of other stuff and then coated it with Teflon and then filed off the hammer spur and every other surface that might snag, including the front sight. It has a rather interesting, what they call the gutter snipe sniping system. It would be considered, maybe not exactly an antique, but I mean, it was the precursor for a whole bunch of features that you find in more modern firearms. But, you know, in its era, this was an exotic, professional, custom-designed concealment weapon. Lexan transparent grip, so you could see the magazine capacity. It was kind of science fiction for its day. You know, it was the, we're going to make a custom-designed weapon for people that need to carry a unobtrusive gun in a considerable caliber. And this is kind of a thing you see in James Bond. Like, you know, the John Gardner books had him using the H&K VP-70, which was one of the early polymer pistols. Bond using something that's just the little next step beyond what's in common usage is kind of a thing. And it's, in a sense, you know, spy novels are kind of, in a sense, our proto-techno thrillers.
Our genre is not called spy-fi without a reason.
I mean, you've got gadgets, you've got gizmos, and the guns are one of the more popular gizmos. Again, the bad guy using an exotic, weird weapon is just a common thing. Look at, obviously, the man with a golden gun, but even go look at Spectre, that bizarro double-barreled 45 pistol that Mr. Hinks is using, or any number of weird or exotic or not previously seen on the screen weapons that we've seen in Bond movies, or whatever the weapon du jour of that's in the popular conscience. I think you have Bond using a 44 Magnum in...
Little Man Die.
This is basically an updating of, okay, Mr. Bond, that Beretta, that's a really serviceable ladies' gun, but, you know, we're going to issue this, you know, this Walther PPK now.
And he literally reminds Boothroyd that it was Boothroyd who got him using the Walther in the first place.
Yes. Yeah. So, this is just, I think this is just a neat updating of that scene, and it's very well drawn and such, and it's you know, you've got Glaser safety slugs, which are also, you know, cutting-edge sci-fi wonder ammo of the era, so It's a neat little sequence, and it's for me, it's kind of in a sense, I don't want to say throwback negatively, it's kind of a neat just snapshot of an era of what was considered cutting edge of a time. And this is very much grounded smack in the Cold War and the 80s and that standoff. But
you might say, and I'm actually a fan of the Dalton Bond movies, you might say that this comic does a better job of tapping into that 80s Cold War zeitgeist than even the Dalton movies did. And again, I'm speaking to somebody who actually holds the living daylights in very high regard, and I think this particular comic actually has that movie beat.
Well, I think there are similarities, because you're trying to get somebody out of enemy territory and over the border and such. So There are a number of elements in this one that I think kind of presage stuff you saw in the other movies and such.
And you see, after we have the boot, also, and it's deliberately, I think, echoing From Russia with Love here, which is that there's basically two kinds of Bond movies. There's From Russia with Love and there's Goldfinger. And this comic is basically both of them, which is amazing to me.
Yeah,
let's see.
Bond is going in to get someone out, or Bond is going to figure out what is going on.
Right.
And that's... I think Goldfinger probably predominates that, if you think about it, in terms of it's something weird is going on. We need you to go figure out what's going on.
Right. Goldfinger is the one with the hidden lair and the megalomaniacal plot and the colorful villain and all the sort of big, larger-than-life kind of things. And From Rush with Love is the one that ostensibly tries to be a slightly grittier, down-to-earth. You've got From Rush with Love, that's where For Your Eyes Only is, right? For Your Eyes Only lives very comfortably in the same space that From Rush with Love inhabits. And Goldfinger and Moonraker, you see, there's your line there. And then we get into the Brosnan era, and I think the analogy breaks down a little bit because they were trying not to do Moonraker, but they were never, unless until we get to Die Another Day. Die Another Day is clearly a Goldfinger, Moonraker.
Well, I think GoldenEye, in a sense, is you've got the big, giant plot.
You do.
And then it gradually builds and builds and builds.
Well, yeah, I think we could probably put most of Brosnan's stuff in the Goldfinger, Moonraker
category. Actually, there's a third category. There's a third category. And Thunderball fits into that. All right, we want Bond, we need to go do a thing, like get this person out. Or Bond, there's something strange going on. We want you to go find out what's going on here.
Yeah.
But there's a third category. It's like Bond is on vacation or doing his thing and notices something strange.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Now, and that's actually kind of how, you know, that's technically, at least on paper, at least according to his report, that's how Spectre started. I was just in vacation in Mexico City for Day of the Dead. It's not my fault I had to shoot the place up.
Sometimes places just blow up.
Yeah. So
does that have anything to do with why? Sometimes places just blow up. Why do you always look at me? Why are you looking at me like that?
Yeah, but look at Never Say Never.
Never Say Never Again. Well, it's obviously in the Thunderball category.
Right, exactly. That's one of those. Bond is at a spa and sees something weird going on. Yeah. It's, you know, Thunderball. You know, I think they spoof it up a bit more in that one.
Probably.
But that's the thing. So there's kind of a third category of Bond is just doing his thing and sees something weird.
Yeah.
And then events spiral out of.
Exactly. Well, anyway, we're going straight into From Rush with Love here because Bond goes to Budapest working on getting Miss Dane out, and we start hooking up with the family of Karen Bay. The action and adventure in the last half of the first volume, we also go back to the 1989 version of the Gypsy Camp, where we run into Karen Bay's daughter. Let me see what her actual name was. There's her name and there's her nickname. I want to make sure I've never said these. You know, in 30 years, I think that you're the only people besides me I've ever known who have read these comics, and you read them because I gave them to you. I don't know anybody that's read this book.
Well, that's because it's apparently impossible to find.
Apparently it's impossible to find, and the publication schedule at the time was kind of jacked up, too. Issues 1 and 2 came out, and there was a difference of some months, perhaps even longer, before issue 3 came out.
That was one thing I was going to ask, because it did kind of have that, you know, 80s indie comics. I remember those.
Yeah. Good times. You got your American Flag, your Nexus, your John Sable, you got Airboy. What else did Eclipse do? They did Airboy, they did...
Try not to get too attached, kids, because you never know when it's going to come back through, if ever again. And of course, these are, I mean, the other thing is, bear in mind, is that this is not digital color, boys and girls.
You know what? For the time, this was extremely, this was like really cutting edge, classy printing and coloring.
Yeah. It doesn't look like.
It doesn't hold up quite the same way.
Even mid-90s comics still kind of look like crap compared to that.
Mid-90s comics, they really needed their Photoshop taken away. They need to take the stuff from Image in 95 and 96.
Take the Photoshop away. I can't remember who was the interview with about the early days of the digital publishing industry. When it's like all of a sudden, you know, people found out, oh, these young interns know how to use this Photoshop and PageMaker thing, and they can do this stuff. We're going to have to spend thousands of dollars to do prepress layout on. So here, quick, you do this. And they had no idea what they were doing, and they were basically just sort of pushing the boundaries of what they could do. And so you get all sorts of things that were just absolutely just design fiascos and train wrecks, but
kind of like early web pages tended to have flashing colors and weird backgrounds.
Oh yeah, I remember I had like a folder full of different of little graphical little bullet points, you know, because I could use a picture instead of just a dot for my bullet list. I have like, you know, 30 40 50 100 really cool bullets and themes and such and little skulls and some, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, it was
were there any flashing lights?
The little spinny police siren thing.
Yeah.
You know, but that I mean, remember, animated GIFs came somewhat later, and then of course, all right, we're gonna do an animated GIF as the background of the web page.
Dun dun.
And all
dun.
The text in flash tags.
So well flash, yeah. Jesus.
Or blink. So, I'm sorry, blink.
Yeah, we're going back in time here, kids. I mean, how many people are? We should put a poll on the website. How many the ages of our listeners? Because there's going to be a certain number of our listeners that were born after the sort of digital events we're talking about that grew up in a more civilized age. And there's going to be a certain number of our listeners who remember those old web pages. And there are going to be a certain number of our listeners who, I don't know.
I usually use your daughter for that, but I don't think she's actually allowed to listen to us. So.
Yeah, I don't let her listen to the show because sometimes daddy swears and she likes to say that her ears are not a toilet.
And sometimes your audio engineer can't be bothered. Yeah, I could beep that out.
And then sometimes
I'm not gonna because I'm gonna, find
gonna,
the
gonna, gonna do it. And then, truthfully, my daughter hears me go on. You see how you listen to me on this show? This is basically how I talk all the time anyway. The only difference is there's a microphone in front of me right now. And my daughter gets a lot of this.
I believe the way you sold us on doing a podcast is if I come over to your house, we're going to talk about stuff for an hour or two or three.
No,
anyway.
That's how your husband sold us on the podcast. This was his idea. Right. I'm not saying he was wrong about it. This is what we're going to do on a Saturday afternoon anyway.
Yeah, well,
and he's not wrong. Let's just put a microphone in front of it and share it with people. The name of the colorist in the back of the book is Julia Lacquement. It's spelled Lacquement. I've never said it out loud. It looks French to me, so I'm just going to say Lacquement.
You sure she's not a character in the book, too? That's a
Bond name. It really is. And I think she was also his colorist on Longbow Hunters, and her work is splendid. I mean, it's beautiful, saturated, painted colors. It's gorgeous.
It did not even occur to me for a second that was not some kind of modern re-release, because I'm so used to... Like, whenever they do the reprints nowadays, the color's always much nicer than it was back in the day. And I said, we've got a whole run of 90s comics that Jimmy gave us for some reason back there, and they look terrible.
They look awful. I mean, because of the Photoshop thing. I was just thinking
the regular color. Just the ink looks weird now because you're used to things looking so much.
Well, that's
having a wider variety of colors.
Well, they're out of these sort of, okay, we don't know what the hell we're doing with Photoshop, and we're experimenting to figure out what the heck works and what doesn't. But there's also a change in the printing technology and the color printing, the paper quality, compare the it doesn't yellow, for example, and it's all the color reproduction is a lot better.
But if you look at this, I swear to God, kids, the colors are beautiful.
Yeah, this is really good.
Beautiful. Yeah.
And it's from 89.
Yeah, this is what they called prestige format back in the day. Started with Frank Miller's Dark Knight, where you would have the square binding and the slick paper, the slick nice paper, heavier paper, the square binding, you know, nice printing. I don't know if they do quite so many books like that anymore, because the general quality of your average comic these days is a lot better than it was then, just the physical object. But yeah, this is beautiful. The colors, the artwork, I mean, they really went top notch with this. I found the name of Karen Bay's daughter, who leads the Gypsies Bond hooks up with. So she says, they named me Luludi. It means flower. But my father called me Botany, B-O-T-A-N-E-E. So her father was Karen Bay. Her name is Luludi Bay, but her father called her Botany Bay. Botany Bay. So that right there is, Mike, if you do actually, Mike, I met you briefly and interviewed you here at the Lexington Comic Con. Yeah, if you're listening to this, and I hope you are, the more we talk, I've read this book every couple of years for like the last 25 years, because this is one of my favorite Bonds. It honestly is. And it really thrills me to be able to share this both with my co-hosts on this podcast and hopefully the people who are listening to this will go track this down. Because if you're a Bond fan and you can find these books these days, because I don't think it's being reprinted anywhere. It's not on Comixology or anything. If you're a Bond fan, put the work in and go find this, because you are going to love it. You are going to love it.
I know that Bay is an Ottoman title, so I don't actually know that the daughter would have it, but now that you say Botany Bay out loud, I'm pretty sure that was intended.
It was intended. It was totally intended. So then that's like a 48 page first issue. You're followed up by two more. Yeah, we talked about spoiler territory earlier, and I think there's some wisdom to this, because if we're talking you into tracking this down, we don't want to wreck it for you. Suffice to say, in book two, there is all kinds of late 80s Cold War Eastern European action scene kind of stuff. There's the army, and there's helicopters, and there's trains, and there's machine guns, and there's Botany Bay again, and there's machine gun emplacements, and there's the niece, and there's explosions and snipers, and oh my god, this is like it would have cost $150 million then to make this movie. Because pen and ink are cheap, right? And then you have book three. Now, books one and two are straight up From Russia with Love, gritty, a little more grounded, more your Ian Fleming book kind of territory.
Expensive action scenes, but not, you know, weird-looking guy with an underground lair kind of thing.
Now, book three, say that phrase again. That was a great phrase.
Weird-looking guy with an underground lair.
Book three is weird-looking guy with underground lair, where we finally meet Mr. Woodsy Odlow, and we get into his motives, and all of a sudden we're in... Well, you know, Bond goes in and there's an underground lair and there's this weird guy with a mask and no, he's probably not a villain, is he? No, surely not.
He literally has the little partial Phantom of the Opera mask and he plays a giant organ.
And the windows look like they were taken right off of the Nautilus.
Yes,
actually,
they were.
A good chunk of the interior layout, I was reminded of 20,000 Leagues in general.
And the last book, Captain
Nemo, who wanted to end war by...
Oh, yeah.
By taking down ships.
Yeah, so this is this an accidental reference? Maybe not. The books 1 and 2 are kind of where we're going with the more grounded, From Rush With Love, realistically scaled action. And book 3 is where we go full-on Goldfinger with a mountain lair and a plot and high technology and all that kind of stuff.
And
so,
mini submarines.
And mini subs. And isn't Felix in there? Isn't Felix,
Felix
in book 3?
Felix,
yes. Felix is in here. And it's like, what more do you want out of a James Bond story at this point?
Well, apparently post-shark Felix.
Yes. And that was the thing that got me. I was like, oh, wait, what happened? Oh, yeah. Because I was like, wait, did Felix lose his hand in... oh, yeah. And that, well, I had to check with Stacey. Like, wait, did Felix later lose a hand in... Okay, So and that's the thing. Kind of, it used in several places very close to the book continuity, which I thought was a nice
touch.
But
it's still... suggestive whenever they kind of do those flashbacks of the movies without actually crossing the IP violation line.
Yeah, and the third one, I mean, you get hints of Dr. No, you know, you get, I mean, it, I'm not saying, I don't mean it's derivative, I mean, just you can see sort of the way the action kind of develops is kind of along those lines. I have any criticism of it, I think it really could have used the wrap-up and the thwarting of the villain's plan is a little abbreviated, is the only, I mean, they do, I mean, in a sense, you know, the second book is all pretty much, the first book is pretty much set up and we're going to go in and cross the border. Oh, we've gotten thwarted by betrayal and it looks like the mission is off. And then Bond says, nope, mission's still on. Going to do this. And then,
as Bond does.
Yeah.
And, as Bond does.
And then the second one is pretty much action and escape and then pursuit and then fleeing the, you know, evading the pursuers and middle part. And the third one, okay, we meet the villain of the piece and you've got Bond is introduced, you know, it's all very civilized and such, but he's not doing anything villainous. Maybe he's on the up-up, something else going on here. And then it turns out he is, but, and they do this great job of setting everything up, but so there's not a lot of pages left for... It doesn't have to be ninja, dozens of ninjas descending on ropes from the roof of the mountain lair, but it seemed a little short.
That may be a function of the footprint he had to work with. You've got 3 issues, 48 pages each. Here's
yeah, and that's the thing. It's serviceable, and again, it's not a criticism. It's not badly done. It's just it's a little quick, and I guess for me it was like, wow, this really built up over 3 issues. The part of it was, okay, really, I wanted another issue.
Well, see, there's what it is. I mean, this is one of those experiences I don't really want it to end, which is why I go back and reread it every couple of years. I mean, every couple of years since it was published, you know, back around 90 or so. This is one of my favorites. I go back to this one. So I guess, Mr. Grell, if you end up listening to this podcast, if you've got any particular feedback about that third issue, were you limited by your page count? My co-host here feels it was just a tiny bit rushed. Was it? I mean, did you have limitations in terms of time? You know, let us know.
I think
let us know. We would love to talk to you about it.
I mean, I think it is maybe a space thing. I mean, there's only so many pages left in it. And again, it's not bad.
The company ceased to exist not too long after that.
So. Yeah, Eclipse didn't make it long into the 90s.
So, I mean, I would have liked to see, you know, make just a full, okay, you're a bit more larger set piece, you know. And again, he spends a whole issue giving you a picture of what the guy's up to and the lair and everything.
Yeah, no, the build-up to the plot is great. It's just like, I actually had to look back a couple pages to figure out why the villain had not won.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, because he does like one thing that you think would not be the thing.
Now we know that Dynamite Comics, Dynamite Publications, the current comics publisher, they do a lot of different things. And amongst what they do are they've got the license to do Bond comics right now. On the incredibly off chance that somebody with any connection at Dynamite is listening to this, you might put a bug in their ear to reprint this. Because a nice Permission to Die hardback. New sketch cover by Mr. Grell, or if you could get Mike Grell to do some covers for you now, or maybe a brand new comic. That would be lovely. It would be great if you could get him to come back and do another book for you. Reprint this one, get him to do new stuff for you. That would be awesome. And if anybody out there has their ear about this, please put a bug in their ear about it.
I mean, one thing about this one very much reminded me of GoldenEye in terms of the way GoldenEye was kind of, I don't want to say greatest hits of James Bond, because I think that's not fair to it, but it really was
we need to stick in everything that works,
a sort of Bond, if you will.
Yeah, and they basically just hit on all of the stuff that makes you think, wow, this is what makes James Bond really cool, and primarily the cinematic Bond.
But because if GoldenEye hadn't worked, it's over,
right?
So you've got to go out there and do the Bondest of Bond movies.
This one very much, it would have made a good Bond movie. This really would have made a pretty good Bond book. This hit on a lot of much of the stuff you'd see in the books. You've got the giant mountain lair and everything, but you've got that Cold War tradecraft with, okay, a few gadgets and gizmos here. We've just got to get this person across the border before the opposition kills us. Oh, yeah. Then, by the way, the hills are alive with the sound of marching Soviet troops.
The hills are alive with the sounds of commies.
It's even more a little bit venal in that the reason that they're rescuing this person is to trade her to a guy that's got a technology that the British government wants.
Could totally use for peaceful satellite launches.
Right.
So it's got the nice gray area where good spy stories frequently live in the gray area. And it's right smack in a nice gray area, and it's got heinous villains and beautiful women and action scenes and gadgets and communists and spycraft and adventure and action. And if there's something you want in a Bond story, be it literary or cinematic, this comic has got it. I mean, this has really got it. I mean, go find this thing. It's not being reprinted right now. It's not currently in print, which is a tragedy because it's fantastic.
Two things. If you're searching for Permission to Die, search for Permission to Die comic.
Yeah, because that's like a whole different
deal.
That's
a whole thing.
That is, shall we say, the phrase Permission to Die in and of itself is perhaps outside the remit of this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
We're not getting into that.
Yes,
on this show.
But that's but as you know, so Permission to Die comic, Permission to Die Mike Grell,
or 007 Permission to Die Mike Grell.
Yes.
Yeah,
How they work in the title, but also just the way the title is a play on
License to Kill.
But Commander Bond is not Permission to Die.
Yeah, and that's because License to Kill isn't like here is your killing license. You have to renew it in 5 years. It's you are allowed. You are given license to.
Right.
You know, in the sense of permission. So this is License to Kill, Permission to Die. And I'm just
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Specifically Q explaining why he provides all these gadgets so that the 00 agents don't get killed. We gave you license to kill, not permission to die.
They would not go wrong by just dropping, by
just reprint this. Yeah, just get it back out there for people to read.
They would not go wrong by saying, okay, Mr. Grell, here's a check, and basically the screenplay. And
and I find it highly unlikely that anyone out there listening has the ear of Michael Wilson or Barbara Broccoli. But if someone out there would happen to have the ear of Mr. Wilson or Miss Broccoli, you could do us all a service and like slip this and send it to somebody's office door with a little note.
This could be updated pretty easily.
You know, if Dan Craig's only doing one more, this would make a superb next Bond movie.
Oh, it even still works with Russia, though.
The technology involved, the villain's launch system is still both reasonably realistic and still just far enough ahead of the curve to be fantastical.
Right. Well, and look at Gerald Bull and the super gun.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah,
the exactly. intrigue surrounding that. So
yeah.
you could totally spin this as, well, we need to get this person out of the Russian sphere of influence, so this other fellow will give us their revolutionary launch technology. Of course, the Russians would, A, like to have her as a bargaining chip for themselves, and B, they don't want someone to get a leap on them in the launch end of business. And there's obviously can we use it to deliver ICBMs? Can we use it to deliver?
It's easily updatable. It's relevant. It's fantastic. So yeah, go to the trouble of finding this. And again, if anyone out there has Dynamite's ear, because they really should get this back out. Now, we've got a treat for you. I was actually able to talk to Mr. Grell we went to the Lexington, Kentucky Comic and Toy Convention this spring. Mr. Grell was a guest there, and I had the very rare delight of talking to him for about 15 minutes. Ostensibly, I went in to interview him about this comic. That actually lasted about 15 seconds.
You got a good three questions in, I think.
Three questions. And then what happens is I end up geeking out with one of my favorite writers and artists about James Bond for about 10 minutes. Rather than interview him about his comic, we end up doing the show with Mike Grell, which was frankly more fun than I should be legally allowed to have. It was just an absolute delight to talk to this guy. Yeah, it was a great pleasure. And Mr. Grell, again, if you're listening to this, thank you so much for your time. That was genuinely a thrill and a pleasure for me. And if you ever come back to this comic convention, I look forward to maybe talking with you again about James Bond. So now we'll cut over to that interview.
Hi, this is Agents of Cool on the floor of the Lexington Comic and Toy Convention. We have the great privilege today to talk to the legendary comic book artist, Mr. Mike Grell. Mr. Mike Grell, welcome to the show.
Thanks, it's great to be here.
In the late 80s, early 1990s, you wrote and drew a 3-issue graphic novel, James Bond, Permission to Die.
Yes.
And if I can say here on the air, for the record, it is one of my favorite James Bond stories ever. Now, for my part, I feel like it captures something very essential about Ian Fleming's writing. It feels very true to the Bond of the books to me and has a lot of the scope of the Bond of the movies in like the best possible way. Could you tell us how you came to get that job? Did you approach them? Who approached you?
I was approached by Acme Press and Eclipse Comics, who were at the moment looking at me because I had done the Longbow Hunters mm-hmm. book for DC Comics, mm-hmm. and I had a background with John Sable Freelance, mm-hmm. my other comic that was hard edge, kind of a nitty gritty mm-hmm. action adventure world traveler kind of a hero. And they came to me and said, "How would you like to do James Bond?" Who could possibly turn it down? And they wanted somebody who could write and draw. Leading up to that, I had done an adaptation of License to Kill.
I didn't know that. I'm gonna have to hunt that down.
It was almost simultaneous, actually. License to Kill was the adaptation of the film, mm-hmm. and they already had the script written, but it needed to be condensed and adapted mm-hmm. For a comic. I did the layouts and did the script for it, but I hired other artists to finish it. But that was all pretty much simultaneous. Mm-hmm. But the Permission to Die, I have to say, the highest compliment I was ever paid, not that yours is anything to sneeze at.
And that's all right.
Raymond Benson, who wrote the James Bond Bedside Companion.
And if there's a bigger authority on James Bond than Raymond Benson, I haven't heard of him.
Right. Raymond called it, and this is a direct quote, "the best James Bond movie I ever read."
Wow. And I'll back that up. Right. That's really good.
It was a joy to work on because I read all the Fleming books time and time again. And I have my favorites, and like anybody else. I was in high school when the films started coming out, and I was instantly attracted to the characters. When I came to designing James Bond, I made him look like Fleming's original model, Hoagy Carmichael.
Yeah.
In fact, if you look at the comic, at the graphic novels, there's a frontispiece illustration with Bond leaning his hand on something, holding the Walter PPK. That's a swipe from a photograph of Hoagy Carmichael leaning on a piano.
That's cool.
A few graphic changes. Changed the hair, gave him the black
scar.
Curl over the eye, gave him the scar, which I changed from Fleming's description, which is a 3-inch long knife scar on his right cheek. And it just seemed to me that a spy, someone who's trying to blend in,
would not
walk around with a distinctive scar, especially in an age when it's so simple to have a scar removed.
Right.
So I gave him the scar, but I made it something that starts above his eyebrow, actually cuts through the eyebrow, and then there's a short flick on his cheekbone, like he was flinching back away from the knife and could have put his eye out.
Yeah.
But I grew up in an area where parenting was a lot different. Kids were not protected.
It's a lot different. It's a lot different.
Mom would send you outside and say, "Make sure you're home when the streetlights come on." And every kid I knew had a scar in his eyebrow.
Yeah.
Falling down the stairs or something like that.
Yeah.
You pick yourself up, walk it off. It's 2.5 feet from your heart. You don't get a long way from dead yet, right?
Exactly.
So I did that, and there were certain restrictions that I had. Like, unfortunately, I couldn't use Q.
Right.
But I could use Boothroyd.
Boothroyd.
Right. And so that's what I did. And I also took time to pay homage to the films.
Mm-hmm.
I had scenes in there from Goldfinger and from Russia with Love and Honor Majesty's Secret Service. Mm-hmm.
Which is, Mr. Lazenby may or may not regret doing it, but God, that's a good movie.
It's my favorite James Bond movie.
It's great.
Of all time. I think the only thing that keeps it from being, in everybody's estimation, the best ever, is the absence of Sean Connery.
If he had hung on,
say that George Lazenby did a bad job.
No, but if Sean had hung on one more movie, just one more.
If he had done that one more, people would still be talking about it today.
And, they would be.
I think it's just an excellent story, though. And that's his concept. And of course, Diana Rigg was always apologetic when she would show up. I saw her on The Tonight Show saying that she had done a James Bond movie, but she didn't think it was really all that particularly good. And she's wrong.
She's wrong. Yeah. She's straight wrong about that.
That and she was magnificent.
Oh, she's
the only person who could have played that
role. Oh, she's the only person that could have been Tracy.
Right.
No question. And it's like... breaks my heart every time. Every time I watch that movie, it's like just, you know it's coming, but it hits you every time.
Right. Well, Eric, you and I are being fanboys together.
Oh, absolutely.
Because
absolutely.
We're like kindred spirits.
Absolutely.
Here.
Now, what do you think, as long as we're talking about Bond, what do you think of Dan Craig?
Oh, I really like him.
We do too.
Yeah.
We've been talking about it. We just covered Quantum of Solace in like real detail a couple of weeks ago, and he's awesome. He's awesome.
LA Times called me up to interview me and asked me what my opinion was of the casting.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I think everybody's going to be really surprised.
Yeah.
Because he's a terrific actor.
Mm-hmm.
He has the charismatic presence, but he also has that truly dangerous edge that after Connery, it was hard to see in James Bond, in the actors that played Bond.
Yeah.
With the exception, Tim Dalton.
He was good.
Did a really
he
good
was
job.
Good.
There were moments when he thought, somebody's in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
A lot of trouble.
Yeah. He was a really good James Bond in... He was an A-grade James Bond in a B-grade James Bond movie. He was an A. If they
exactly
given
right.
If they had given him a script like Casino Royale, like you're saying, we'd still be talking about that one too. Back to Permission to Die. Was there any influence from the John Gardner books in the 80s, like choice of weapon, the way his car was? Was there any influence from the John Gardner books?
The choice of weapon, I went to the Asp for a couple of reasons, but I did put the PPK in there in the opening sequence, so we'd have character recognition.
Right.
The car wasn't that large of a factor. I thought giving them a Volvo was stupid.
That's Simon Templar's car, isn't it? Doesn't the Saint drive a Volvo?
I have no idea.
I think the Saint drives a Volvo. So I.
He would.
He would. And he would.
He would. He would. But James Bond would not drive a Volvo.
No.
So when I did show a car in there. I showed the Aston Martin.
Aston Martin.
Right. The Asp made pretty good sense because the pistol itself is really quite high tech for the time. I don't know if you've ever seen one in photographs.
I have not.
Handled one, but
I have not.
The promotion says it's so smooth on all the edges and everything else, and the Teflon coating on the outside, that feels like a bar of soap, and it does. It's very slick, very sexy. It's got some cool stuff, and at that time, there were no compact 9mm. Mm-hmm. To make an Asp, you had to start with a full-size Smith & Wesson 9mm, mm-hmm. and then chop it down to make it into the Asp.
I didn't know that.
And it took a lot of internal stuff to make it actually work and function.
Now, see, he'll appreciate
trick
that.
Gun. Yeah.
He's kind of our firearms expert. He's going to appreciate knowing that. He's going to like that.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite? Her Majesty's Secret Service is your favorite Bond movie?
Yes.
Connery's your favorite Bond?
Yes.
Connery's Bond.
Yes.
He is Bond. Dan Craig comes close. Dan Craig comes awfully close. And I think if Tim Dalton had better scripts, he'd have been around a little bit longer.
Yeah.
License to Kill still kind of plays like a Miami Vice episode, but he's so good in it. He's so good in that movie. And it's like, I feel like he's really underappreciated.
License to Kill, I think, was really great. Up until number one, they got to Las Vegas, and all of a sudden, here comes Wayne Newton.
Yeah.
And number two, the scene where they're fighting on the treadmill where all the blocks of cocaine are being dropped into the grinder.
Yeah.
Nobody's wearing a respirator.
Yeah.
And nobody's high.
And nobody's high. Right. Exactly.
At the end of that scene, the guy who falls in could probably have tap danced on the cutting
blade. Yes, like, absolutely. Hey, he's so high from all that. It's a great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for sharing your time today. My pleasure.
Thanks.
Now, see, that's a great guy, kids. That's a great guy to talk to right there. Now we're at the end, and then I am your grumpy number six. My email is grumpynumber6, lowercase, all letters, at agentsof.cool. Ray?
Ray at agentsof.cool.
Mrs. Peel, MRSPEEL, no period, at agentsof.cool.
As always, we love to hear from you. There's the one guy that emailed us. More of you should email us. I mean, there's a good chance we're going to read your email on the show, and there's a good chance we're going to do a show. If you suggest a show, there's a pretty good chance we're going to do it.
Sorry about our low volume there, but guy who emailed us is totally getting the show that
he's getting his show, I swear to God. So yeah, please email us about this. If you have any particular insight into comment about the comics, please let us know about that. If you go and find them and enjoy them, we would love to hear your opinion of them.
Looks like they are available. You know, you can find them here and there. The prices, it's not like, you know, Rembrandt, super expensive first printing. So they're out there. They're not impossible to find. Frankly, you're probably in better shape to find them now than, say, Eric was,
I had to look pretty hard to find these back in the day. Printing distribution was kind of sketchy there towards the end of Eclipse. In that day and age, I think we had a multitude of comic stores here in Lexington. We had the Comic Connection. We had the Comic Interlude. Now, you know what? This was before the 90s boom. As the 90s boom continued, we had a lot of shops spring up around town, but back around 89 and 90, we had the Connection and we had the Interlude, and if memory serves, that was about it. But it took a little doing to find these, but it was so worth it then, and it will be so worth your time now. As always, thank you very much for listening, and we'll have a new show out for you soon. Good night.
That's why I couldn't remember what it's called. Because it uses like one vowel.
There's like one. Is that Scottish or is that like, you know, Scottish Eastern European? Yep. What was that story on The Onion about how we were flying in a load of vowels to Yugoslavia as a relief effort?
One of the great tragedies of World War I was all the reparations to Great Britain that were paid, and apparently involved all the vowels. That's why you've got all those extra O's and U's in UK English, and you have no vowels at all in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, that was, they showed very little foresight in that.